To the Unrestricted Area, a basketball intelligence podcast. Go to basketballintelligence.net to sign up for your daily email in which I and my partners painstakingly hand curate the most important NBA and NBA draft stories of the day. Make sure to subscribe to this pod and follow us at @bballispoetry and at @ticketrules on X. Today, my partner Ray LeBove and I are speaking with Nick Agar-Johnson from Kings Weekly and No Ceilings. We discuss some role players who have unexpectedly emerged this season to become key components of their team. It's a great conversation, and it's likely our last look back at the regular season before we dive into the playoffs, so I hope you enjoy.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here with you and Nick, and welcome everyone. Today we're going to talk about players who this season, regardless of how long they've been in the league, elevated themselves to unexpectedly more significant role with their team. And some of the inspiration for this is from past seasons where you've seen players like Alex Caruso or Austin Reeves, and you can think of many others as well who've done that in previous seasons. Well, that happens every season. And I look at this as kind of as a distant relative of the most important player, most improved player conversation. And I think one of the important differences is, so we're not going to be talking about Tyrese Maxey. But one of the important differences, I think, is that there doesn't seem to be any criteria for most improved player other than they're a player. We want to have some sense of some criteria that is more universal among the people that we're going to be talking about. So what I'd like to look at for each of these players is the what, the how, and the why of how they emerged unexpectedly to play that more significant role that we've talked about. You know, is it fit? Is it opportunity, perhaps from injuries? Is it improvement? Is it a more general improvement or a specific improvement, a particular skill that was needed? Had they been overlooked either in the draft or elsewise? As to what they could bring to a team, were they misjudged, et cetera. So there's a lot of different reasons. And I would also, in some instances, to the extent possible, to sort of get a feeling of where you think the future is, what might happen, what does their improvement this year mean going forward to the extent that we can glean that at all. I'd like to start off with taking a look at Miles McBride from the Knicks. And Nick, you want to start us off with that?
Yeah, so with Miles McBride, he's someone who is in a category of player that I think is relatively common, of a guy who was taken in the second round to a certain team, in this case the Knicks, thought could be a valuable bench piece, could be someone who could be, you know, third string point guard, essentially, you know, get them under a cheap contract as you get for a second round player and, you know, have them around for a while, essentially as someone who, you know, would be useful to have on the end of the bench. With McBride, the calling card coming in was the defense. And that's really, you know, what we saw even in the limited sample size of his play during the first couple of seasons is, wow, you know, he's a bit undersized at 6'2", but he's very sturdy, got an incredibly sturdy frame, hard to push around, which is, you know, I think pretty important, especially for your relatively undersized defense first guards. But in his first couple of years in the league, really his shot just didn't fall at all. I mean, he hit 25% of his threes his rookie year. He was under 30% in his sophomore season when he got a slight uptick in playing time. This year, really what it's been in terms of what's earned him more playing time is just much more efficient on the offensive end. I mean, from, you know, in the 60s free throw shooting on minimal sample size to not much larger sample size, but still shooting 86% from the free throw line this season. He's up to 41% from three-point range, which is closer to what he shot his sophomore season at West Virginia, after which he declared for the draft. So with McBride, I think a lot of it also is that the Knicks just have fewer point guard minutes than they did last year, which, you know, certainly is a huge part of any of these players earning any sort of opportunity. But with McBride, I think the big driver is just the defense was there and the offense needed to come around. And that's really been what we've seen from him this year.
Okay, let's talk about Keon Ellis. As many of you know, I'm here in Sacramento, so I've gotten to see Keon play a lot, and he has never played much of a role until very recently. And when he has played that role recently, in part driven by injuries that opened up time to play, the Kings have been a for quite some time now a horrendous defensive team. And Keon is a one of to me, if he were a full-time player, having played full-time for the year, would be a very strong candidate for all defense for the league. And I think what's remarkable about his play defensively, which to me is magnificent, is that that seemed to have turned the defense of the Kings around. They went from being horrid to being quite good. And I don't see any other explanation. Of course, there's multiple explanations, better effort, et cetera, better scheme, et cetera. But the addition of Keon Ellis to the lineup and the minutes that he plays, and both as an on-ball and off-ball defender, which is a pretty rare combination to be great at both. He's really been significant. And I would add to that, he has been surprisingly effective offensively as well, which is, I think, you add that to the mix, and he's up near the top of my list for unexpectedly wonderful play this year. And I know, Nick, you're here in the Sacramento area as well, and probably have something to add to that.
Yes, I am also calling in from Sacramento. And yes, I also have quite a bit to say about Keon Ellis. Keon is a fascinating one in this list, in that, with Miles McBride, he was the 36th pick. And I was slightly higher on him his draft year. I had a first round grade on him. But, again, it was back end of the first round. It wasn't like he was expected to go in the lottery and fell all the way to 36. But getting drafted early in the second round means at least some team thought it was worth taking a flyer on you. Keon Ellis started his college career at a community college. He's been someone who's flown under the radar basically every single year until this one. He went to community college, transferred to Alabama, played very well at Alabama, but was not someone who was on many draft boards. I admittedly did not, have him as someone who would have been in the top 60 picks in that year. And, with Keon, it's not the story of, okay, he's someone who people believed in as a prospect, but, had a real breakout year. With Keon, it's just entirely, I mean, not out of nowhere, but essentially out of nowhere. I mean, last year he was on a two-way and he played a grand total of 71 minutes the entire season, which, tells you that he's not exactly someone who the Kings expect to be part of their plans. But he broke into the lineup, really the first time he broke into the lineup this season was due to injury. And the second time he broke into the lineup was also due to injury. I mean, he got his first career start this season after De'Aaron Fox went down with injury. And you and I have talked to the point where I'm sure Kings Weekly fans are sick of it about the game that the Kings play against OKC earlier in the year when the Kings beat Oklahoma City 105-98 with De'Aaron Fox out. And Ray, it was exactly what you mentioned. It was the impact that Keon Ellis has on the Kings defense, not just as someone who can, be a shutdown guy, but, first of all, a shutdown guy in a different mold than Davion Mitchell, who was, the Kings shutdown guy the year before. But Keon has half a foot on him, which makes defensive versatility a little bit easier to see. But, something else, Ray, that you and I have talked about quite a lot with Keon is that he allows the rest of the Kings players to slot into more comfortable defensive positions. He gives guys that extra half second to rotate on the perimeter that they wouldn't have had Keon not been, camping out waiting for them. He, gives point guards when he's pressuring them on the perimeter, he gives them that exact half second more of hesitation that allows Domantas Sabonis to slide closer towards the rim. It's that kind of thing that just has such an outsized impact on the defense. And with the offensive stuff, there's a lot that Keon can't do, and I want to start there for a very specific reason, which is, he's not got the best handle. He's not someone who you expect to drive all the way to the basket. Even in his best games, he's not someone who's chucking up a lot of shots, right? But what he can do, he does very well. And that's, I think, the key for him is he takes the vast majority of his shots from 3-point range, and he's hit 41% this season. And, you know, he's not someone who, you know, he can make the, you know, right read to keep the ball moving, but he's not someone who, you know, you're going to rely on to create a lot of offense. But what he does is expends the vast majority of his energy on the defensive end of the floor. And when he is involved in the offense, it's just doing a lot of the sort of, you know, running around screens kind of handoff stuff that Kevin Huerter was doing when he was healthy, that Keegan Murray has been doing this year and did, you know, arguably more of last year. It's really with Keon just fitting a role offensively and just being, as you've said time and time again, a disruptor on the defensive end.
Well, interesting that you mentioned on what role he plays in the offense. You described to me an almost perfect role to play when you have a player like Sabonis creating those handoffs, for example. So it's really a great fit. Let's move on to talk about Nikola Jovic, which another player that I'm very fond of. Mike, as you probably remember when we watched him in Summer League. I was extremely impressed with many of the
Right.
different aspects of his play and was hoping that he was going to get a larger chance to play this year, which he didn't at first. I'm glad to see what's happened. You know, in part, I suspect it's, well, in part, we know that it's injury related from other players, but also, you know, we talked about fit and other things a little bit earlier. It's one of those things, I guess you could almost talk about Wembanyama and Pop, where, gee, it's nice that Nikola got to land with Eric Spoelstra and, you know, had the right type of fit and surroundings to make the necessary improvements in his game to become a player of significance with the team. I'm going to turn it over to either or both of you to talk about some of those things. One of the things that I particularly like, of course, I'm very partial to big men with small men skills. And
Yeah.
so that's why I'm particularly happy. I really love his game.
Yeah, and I think that's something that the Heat organization has traditionally valued. Like you go back, they've always liked to have big men with kind of funky skills, often, you know, small-minded skills, you could say, whether it was Myers Leonard as an early stretch five, more recently Kelly Olynyk, right? Like Jovic obviously is not a center like those guys are, but he's tall and he's lanky, and most importantly, he pushes the pace. And I think one of the things that Miami really struggles with is getting the ball up the court and getting into their sets quickly. They really like to walk it up. They like to mismatch hunt a little bit, particularly when Jimmy's on the floor. But they need somebody who can just add a little bit of chaos on offense. Like God knows they struggle to score as it is. And one thing that Jovic does is he gets them moving. And sometimes that's just, especially with Kyle Lowry gone, he was the guy who was the best at that beforehand. Without Lowry around, like they just need somebody who's able to like get the offense literally into gear, whether it scores or not. And I think that's something that they really appreciated. His defense has always been a bit of a struggle. You know, he's willowy. He's not the fleetest laterally, I would say. But the Heat are used to making poor defenders work if they can shoot, you know, whether it's Tyler Hero or it's Duncan Robinson. Having Bam Adebayo on the back line does a lot of work in that regard. And so everything starts with the shooting. And if you can make a shot, which Jovic has this year, they'll find a way to get you some playing time in Miami.
Well, I think I would sort of add to that all virtually all of these players that we're talking about, and the reason why you could point to why it took some time for them to rise to the level is none of them are totally well-rounded players, right? They have
Right.
particular skills, and part of this development is, yes, they've worked on developing those skills further. Yes, they've worked on developing other skills. And yes, they're a particular fit for what that particular team either needed or has developed a need for through injury, et cetera. So yeah, I'm concurring with you regarding, you know, that there are strengths and weaknesses in this game, but I would say that that's, you know, significantly a factor as to why we came up with this list or how a player got onto this list. So let's talk about Kobe White. Nick, you want to start that one off?
Yeah, Kobe White is a very interesting case in that of all the guys on this list, he's the only one who was taken in the lottery. And, you know, he's also the oldest player in terms of time in the league on this list by a pretty significant margin. And, you know, Kobe White is sort of an interesting tale of the case in that He was someone who was massively shocking when he got drafted where he did during his draft year. He was, you know, someone who was not expected to go in the top seven of his draft year. And he had a very strong start. You know, he was fifth in rookie of the year voting his first season. He got a larger role in his second year in Chicago. And then he proved one of the most frequently stated adages over at No Ceilings, which is that development is not linear. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where, yeah, sure, you would say, oh, wow, you know, he went from, you know, being a contender for rookie of the year to, you know, a bigger role in year two. Clearly, year three is going to be the breakout, right? You know, year three, people talk about a lot for breakouts. It's when John Morant had his big breakout. It's, you know, when Derrick Rose had his big breakout. It's a common thing for point guards where, you know, you sort of discuss the first 2 years as being figuring things out. And then year three is when you really throw it all together. With Kobe White, you know, he actually had pretty significant fall offs in year three and year four in terms of his involvement in Chicago offense. And this year has been when, you know, he really sort of finally, quote unquote, put it all together. But, you know, a lot of that is just, you know, first of all, he's playing point guard more consistently. Last year, he, you know, spent a lot of time at off guard, which is not exactly the best place for him. And, you know, part of it also is there's a lot of scoring responsibility that he had on his shoulders because Zach LaVine missed so much time that, you know, allowed him to sort of have that room to not even expand his game as much as re-expand his game. Because again, you know, this is essentially, you know, he's certainly shown some improvement, particularly in terms of his ability to get into his three-pointers off the dribble. But, you know, really, he hasn't taken as much of a dramatic stride forward from year two to year five. It's more that he sort of took a step back the last couple of years, and now finally in year five has started to put it all together.
Yeah, you know, to expound upon that a little bit further, I think Kobe's a great example of just how much context matters for players, too. You know, Nick mentioned he kind of looked like he was trending in an interesting direction after his second year, averaged 15 points a game. And then the third year, it was 21-22, is the summer where the Bulls added DeMar DeRozan. And so DeRozan coming in addition to LaVine, in addition to Vucevic, just suddenly there wasn't as much room for an offense-first guard, right? And I think, to Kobe's credit, in his fourth year, even though he was playing fewer minutes, he really started to improve his defense. And that kind of kept him afloat in the rotation until more opportunity opened up for him this season. Even though, obviously, defense has not been his calling card this year, I think, because there has been, you know, the injury to LaVine and there's been room for more scoring on Chicago, it's allowed him to kind of flourish in the way that people maybe thought was more likely based on the way his second season had gone. And one more point to about Kobe this year that I think is interesting is that even though he is scoring more without LaVine, obviously, when LaVine's in the game with Kobe, he's still averaging 15, almost 16 points a game, four assists on the almost the exact same shooting percentages as when LaVine is out. So I think there's still some room for them to coexist if that's the direction that Chicago decides to go in the future. But we've also seen how good Kobe can be without LaVine, averaging 21 points a game without him this year. So I don't know what the Bulls are going to do. It sure seems like they're just going to stand pat and run it back every year. But at this point, guessing them to trade anybody is a bit of a fool's goal. But I think that Kobe can be successful in Chicago either way.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I would mention here is that his inclusion speaks to the flexibility of our criteria for getting someone on the list. But I believe in a very rational way. We're being true to and consistent with our general theme, but how you get there consistent with that theme, I think he's a great example of the flexibility of how we're conducting this. Peyton Pritchard is certainly an example of a player who has made the most out of greater opportunity. How much of that is did he force the creation of that opportunity? How much of it was timing? How much of it was working on various other skills, et cetera? It'd be interesting to kind of explore how he has risen to the level that he's risen on in the chart, also known as Joe Mazzulla's brain. He's come through for them in very significant ways, in very significant specific context. So who wants to take that one?
I can start off. I think to your point, like Pritchard's story is maybe a little bit easier to understand than some of these other guys, because like if you look at his production, it's not like vastly improved the season in general, like on a per minute basis or anything like that. But if it is, he has gotten more opportunity and he has, you know, dominated when he's had the chances. And we've seen he's a scoring smaller guard, right? And on a team like Boston in the past, it's had a lot of depth that hasn't always been something that they've needed. This year though, you know, I don't want to even say that they're top heavy, because obviously they have an insane lineup, one of the most talented rosters we've seen since the Durant Curry Warriors, right? But they're not a team.
There's not that many teams in the league that their seventh player is better than the first player of.
Yeah, no, exactly. And like, I think, but after that, there's a lot of opportunity. And, you know, Pritchard has risen to the occasion. He's a good shooter from outside. He's very aggressive looking for a shot, which is something that I don't think people necessarily, like, obviously draft picks like Nick knew this coming in, but that's not something that casual NBA fans maybe would have expected from this, like, little undersized kind of squirmy point guard who's not super athletic. What I like about Pritchard though, is that like, he's clearly been putting in the work behind the scenes. At the end of last season, his third, he actually requested a trade, if people remember. And basically Brad Stevens had to bring him and be like, listen, man, we've got plans for you. Like, hold the course, everything will work out. And at the end of the summer, he got rewarded with like a pretty fat contract of $30 million for 4 years, which it was a lot more than like his on-court production in his first 3 years maybe would have warranted, but it showed the work he'd been putting in behind the scenes. The Celtics valued that, and they knew how good he would be given an opportunity, and he has rewarded them in kind with the play he's had this season. One quick note about his play before I turn it over to Nick for any further comments, but like the thing you can point to is something that he has dramatically improved upon is taking care of the ball. And I think that that has been the key to his success. And one of the reasons why Coach Mazzulla has trusted him more this season is, you know, the shooting numbers and scoring is great, but if you're turning it over at a high rate, like there's just not room for that in the Boston offense. And his turnover rate, he's actually averaging fewer turnovers on a per game basis, despite playing like 50% more minutes. And I think that's very impressive and very important for a guy who, you know, is trying to establish himself as a rotation player.
Yeah, just sort of building on that. I mean, when you're a 6'1 guard, you have to do a lot more things right than you do wrong just to get playing time in the first place. And so for someone like Pritchard, just cutting down on the mistakes, you know, I mean, his assist numbers have gone up, but I think a lot of that is just due to not just increased playing time, but I think an important element is the players that he's playing with in that increased playing time, right? It's not just I'm purely playing with bench lineups, so, you know, I guess I'm going to have to look for the shot myself because I am not really sure about the guys around me being able to score, right? I mean, him playing with the starting guys as much as he had, you know, that opens up a lot more assist opportunities, but purely just in terms of the turnovers in the taking care of the ball, again, you know, when you're a smaller guard like Pritchard, you have to take as few things off the table as possible. And so him making that improvement is, you know, very significant on that front. There's also sort of the more obvious element of the fact that this year's Celtics team does not have Marcus Smart, does not have Malcolm Brogdon, which, you know, those two things alone are, I think, pretty significant factors in Pritchard getting more minutes, you know, regardless of any of the sort of improvements that he may or may not have made over the course of the offseason.
Okay, let's move on to Peyton Watson, who's very interesting. And I think, you know, the various aspects that we've been talking about today in terms of how a player might get on this list, fit is a really important one for Peyton with the Nuggets, to have a very specific defined role that really exploits his strengths and really is not that big a deal in terms of what his weaknesses are because of the strengths of the other players, et cetera, et cetera. So, Nick, I know you scouted him not that long ago before he was an NBA player, and maybe you want to add to that?
Yeah, Peyton Watson is a fascinating one because he was a very clear top 10 player in his recruiting class. And, you know, you mentioned the fit with Denver. That was the opposite of the fit at UCLA, where he basically didn't get on the floor at all because Mick Cronin didn't trust him. And, you know, when he did get on the floor, he showed a lot of flashes of exactly what left everybody so enticed with his high school film. You know, wow, what a spectacular athlete. And, you know, he's got much better ball skills than you expect for someone of his size. And, you know, if only he could, you know, put together, you know, slightly more effective of an offensive game, then we'd get to see this shot blocking, weak side rim protecting menace all the time. And instead, you know, it's funny because, you know, Jaime Jaquez was on that team, but, you know, nobody at UCLA could really figure out how to get him involved in the offense in an effective way. And so draft time came around and, you know, a lot of the internal discussion at No Ceilings, as well as the sort of discussion in the wider draft world at large, is well, you know, we don't want to draft him too far because he's still this guy that was, you know, spectacularly talented in high school. But if you're betting purely on high school film for guys who did not succeed at the college level, it's a very dicey exercise. And so, you know, with Watson, it's the kind of situation where, again, you know, he does end up going in the first round, but nowhere near as high as he would have gone if he'd been able to have been drafted straight out of high school. And instead of going to a team that tried to rely on him too much on both ends of the floor, he goes to a team where, I mean, is there a better learning environment for anybody than the Denver Nuggets of, you know, the last couple of years? And, you know, he came in last year on the title team, and it was essentially what, you know, he was at UCLA, except in an environment where it was much more acceptable is not the right word, but, you know, Denver was not expecting anywhere near as much of him as UCLA was. And so, you know, he plays bit minutes in 23 games. He's a very effective defender in those minutes. He, you know, throws down a few ridiculously athletic dunks. But other than that, he essentially just sits on the bench and learns for a year. And this year, you know, a lot of the positive signs that people saw in his high school tape have come to roost where, okay, this guy actually reads the floor really well. And however well he read the floor before, he's reading it better now than he was in college. And okay, you know, the shot is still not exactly there, but this is a team that can, you know, work around that better than almost anybody else, right? Like if you're going to have a four out lineup with Nikola Jokic out, that's fine, right? That's not going to be a problem if Peyton Watson is the dive man, if Peyton Watson's the guy in the dunker spot. And so really it's been, you know, a combination of a guy who had a skill set that clearly would play in some NBA environments mixed with him going to the absolutely perfect environment. Because if he goes to Charlotte, you know, it's probably, I mean, you know, they're very different players, but probably a very similar situation to James Bouknight of incredibly talented prospect, doesn't have a team that plays to his strengths, that allows him to develop at any sort of reasonable pace, and all of a sudden they're falling out of the league in 2 years, right? And I was, you know, I think Peyton Watson, you know, ultimately had more reasons to believe in him than James Bouknight did, but Bouknight is someone that a lot of people missed on. It's, you know, not exactly an uncommon thing, but with Watson, really, again, there are a lot of ways that you could see that not working out, and instead he went to the perfect place for it to work out, and now we're seeing, you know, what he could potentially build on going forward. I mean, if he develops a three-point shot, then even more dangerous, but even as he is now, again, he landed in the perfect environment for him to maximize his skill set, which oftentimes is what you're talking about when you're talking about players that are qualifiers for this particular list.
Well, there's so many things that lined up appropriately and necessarily in order for him to be, I'm sure, most importantly to him, on our list, but also how he's succeeding in the league. You know, the right fit, the right team drafting him, the right developmental situation, the right things that are required of him, et cetera, and on and on and on. And the best, one of the very, very best front offices for drafting, et cetera. So everything was worked out perfectly, both for him and the team. What that means going forward, you know, he's not playing that many minutes a game. What does that mean for what he wants to do and what, you know, will his development will mean? Who knows? You know, as Jokic gets older, who knows? Yeah, it's a great, the stars lined up, and he and they have taken perfect advantage of it. So, Mike, talk to us about Julian Champagne.
Yeah, this is somebody who is near and dear to my heart. Second-year player now on the Spurs. Kind of an interesting path to the league. He, you know, was, I think, a 20-point scorer in college, and I don't want to overstep my bounds. College is more Knicks thing. But he went undrafted, signed with the 76ers on a two-way, and was eventually released. And the Spurs kind of snapped him up at the very end of last season when they were trying to tank for Wemby. And they're like, all right, let's just take a flyer on this guy and see what he can do. And it turns out he could do a whole lot, at least when it came to shooting the ball. So he hit 41% of his threes on really high volume for them in the last like month of the season last year. And so they're like, yeah, you know, maybe we should keep him around and see what he can do. And they signed him to a four-year contract this year. So they were impressed with his offseason work as well. Then he basically just never missed again. Shot well in summer league. Has shot pretty well this season, but even this season, his journey has been super interesting because he pretty much didn't play to start the year. Then, if you recall, the Spurs were a mess for the beginning of the year. Wemby was playing out of position at power forward next to Zach Collins, who played pretty horribly in that position, unfortunately. And eventually they said, finally, they were like, all right, we got to get Wemby center minutes, see what he can do. And a week after that happened, they're like, oh, we actually need more shooting around Wemby to make this really work. See a Keldon Johnson, take a seat on the bench, and in comes Julian Champagny. And you know, he's shooting decently, 36% on reasonable volume. But what's exciting about him is he actually provides a nice element of weak side rim protection. So my favorite thing is when you're watching Spurs games, you're going to see a lot of blocks, and most of them are Wemby. Every once in a while, you'll see a guy come flying out of the screen. You're like, who the heck was that? And you see it's always Champagny. And he just has like a knack for getting his hands on the ball. And frankly, there aren't that many shots that go uncontested in San Antonio these days. And I think Wemby is, of course, the primary driving force behind that. But I think Champagny's done really nicely filling in any defensive gaps that need to be there next to Wemby. The two together have had a pretty solid defensive rating when they're on the court together, despite some, let's call it, lackluster perimeter defenders around them. I think he's just the exact kind of 3-and-D role player that you want to find. As, you know, maybe he's not a starter on a really good team. Maybe he ends up being like a seventh man, but like guys who can hit threes consistently and play consistent defense tend to stick in the league for a long time. And I think that he's going to be one of those guys. But, you know, my favorite story from him is I remember when he got promoted to the starting lineup, somebody asked, he had a pretty decent stretch right after he got promoted to a starter. And someone's like, oh, what did Greg Popovich tell you about starting? He said, he told me three words. They never talked to me again. He said, don't be Kobe. And that was it. So he's like, I got out here. I took his message hard. I'm shooting when I'm open and I'm playing defense otherwise. And I thought that was pretty good.
So just to add one little thing about what you were saying about there are not that many shots to be blocked because Victor's blocking so many of them. You have to add into that all the shots that are not taken because Victor's on
right.
the floor. People pass up, I don't know how many shots a game, half a dozen at least, and probably significantly more than that, that under normal conditions, normal being anything other than Victor, those shots never get taken. Thanks for that. Nick, want to talk to us about Derrick Jones Jr.?
Actually, I wanted to stick with Champagny for
another
minute.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. And then you can segue right into Derrick.
So I think the don't be Kobe point is exactly indicative of, you know, and admittedly, I've been, you know, done pretty decently with this list overall in terms of my draft evaluation, but Champagny was someone who I was not as high on as certainly history indicates I should have been. And I think a huge part of that is, you know, going back to that don't be Kobe thing, you know, at St. John's, he was the alpha and the omega of the offense, and he took basically every shot. And so, right. you know, his college shooting numbers weren't particularly efficient. I mean, 31% his freshman season from three-point range, 34% his junior year after which he was drafted, you know, 38% his sophomore season. But, you know, if you look at his shooting splits from college, it's a guy who, you know, had the ball essentially whenever he wanted it and, you know, shot again, essentially whenever he wanted it. And so that's another very interesting sort of draft evaluation of, okay, you know, look, this guy was the man at every single level that he has played basketball in his entire life. And it's funny because Champagny is a very specific exception just because his twin brother's also in the league, which, you know, okay, maybe not the only guy who had NBA talent, you know, in his own home, much less on, you know, his high school team. But the conceptual idea here is, okay, if you're one of those, you know, guys who's a remarkably high scorer, who's the entirety of their offense at the college level, where do you go from there? And I think there's two pretty clear diametric opposite paths. And I'll call them the Marcus Smart path and the Jimmer Fredette path, where Marcus Smart was, you know, essentially known for his offense more than anything else at Oklahoma State. And he gets to the league and he realizes, okay, I'm not going to be a 20 point per game scorer. How do I adjust my game so that I stick around in the league for as long as possible? And Marcus Smart then evolved into the defensive player of the year, you know, exceptional, do everything kind of player that we know today. Whereas Jimmer Fredette, you know, his story was, okay, you know, I'm a 30 point a game scorer and I get to the NBA. And instead of just, you know, spotting up and, you know, being a role player who, you know, chucks up a 3-pointer every time I get into the game, no, I want to try and monopolize the ball like I always have. And, you know, he ended up finding a level where he could continue to do that. And that happened to be the Chinese Basketball Association instead of the National Basketball Association. And so that's, you know, I think the key thing for me with Champagny is, he was someone who very easily could have gone down the Jimmer Fredette path of, no, I only work when I have the ball in my hands all the time. And if I don't, then, you know, I'm not going to be able to contribute in other ways. And instead, he's very much indicating so far anyway that he's going down more of the Marcus Smart path of, look, what do I need to do to fit in? What do I need to do to earn minutes in this rotation and continue to get playing time? And that's the kind of situation where, you know, you can find a lot more 20-point-a-game college scorers than guys who become valuable NBA role players. And a huge part of that is being willing to make that adjustment in the first place.
I would suspect that if he had chosen a path different than the one he selected, that he would, you could measure in milliseconds how long he would have lasted with Pop.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, like Nick said, it's such a huge credit to these guys who go from the alpha and omega and everything, and then they become bit players, but they are bit players who are going to be around for a while by changing their mindset, right? Like, I think it's really good self-awareness of these guys and very realistic take. And not everybody can do that, right? It's hard to be that mentally flexible, and it's hard to take that blow to your ego where, you know, you might end up trying to conform into a role that you know limits you to a fifth man, sixth man, seventh man, even if you think your ceiling is higher than that, right? Like, I think for a lot of these guys, what they're doing, they're putting themselves into a box, the 3-and-D box, or, you know, whatever it might be. And they know that that is going to limit their upside, but it puts such a high floor on their career. And that's just a very mature thing to do. And it's hard to make mature decisions when you're 19 years old. Pretty much everyone listening, I'd imagine, was 19 at one point. And, you know, think about what you were like then and think if you could kind of swallow your pride and accept that. And I think it's really cool.
It might limit your upside, but on the other hand, it means you have an upside.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, nobody ever wants to sell themselves short in the NBA. These are all guys who have bet on themselves one way or another, and it's always panned out up until this point, right? So I just think that's interesting.
Yeah, so, no, you have to have an insane level of confidence just to make it to the NBA in the first place. And so to be willing to take that minor step back is something that it's not a given. And, you know, we see time and time again for the Jimmer Fredettes of the world that it's not always a guarantee that they'll be able to see, okay, you know, I'm unfortunately only among the 150 to 300 best basketball players in the world rather than the, you know, 10 best basketball players in the world. And so I have to change my mindset if I'm going to be a player that sticks around in the NBA rather than, you know, again, someone who has a very long, you know, successful career where they score a whole lot of points, just not in the National Basketball Association.
Yeah. There's a lot to be said for forcing yourself to be reality based.
Yeah. You know, one guy that this conversation actually reminds me of, it's a slightly different archetype, but a similar story, is Dennis Smith Jr., who, if we had done this list last year, you know, would have been probably the first name on it as a guy who was a offense first player, like even came like fifth, I think, in rookie of the year voting, you know, put up real points in the NBA too. This is not a guy who had like zero success. Then Luka comes into Dallas and, you know, things spiral south for him quickly. And he was like very close to out of the league before he was able to reinvent himself into this kind of tough nosed, gritty, defensive minded guard. And now he's like carved out a nice little niche for himself. And, you know, the offense has really never developed to the point that anybody watching him probably hoped it would. But the defense has become such a selling point for his career that he's going to be able to hang around for a long time, I think. Yeah. Anyway.
So, Nick, now let's do that.
Yeah, so I mistakenly mentioned before that Coby White was the longest NBA tenured player on the list. It's not. It's Derrick Jones Jr. who we're getting to now. And it's funny because with Derrick Jones Jr., he had such an obvious NBA level of athleticism to the point where, you know, there's a difference between guys who are elite athletes by, you know, general standards than elite athletes by NBA standards. And Derrick Jones Jr. was among the most athletic players in basketball from the moment that he stepped on an NBA floor. And that's the kind of thing where, you know, look, teams are always going to be more willing to take chances on guys who have that obvious of a skill, right? It's like, you cannot teach Derrick Jones Jr.'s ability to jump into the air.
Let me stop you right there for 1 second, because this actually has something that grinds my gears for years, which is people always say the greatest travesty in like the NBA is that Aaron Gordon never won a dunk contest. I think that might be true, but Derrick Jones Jr. beat him in the 2020 dunk contest. And this is something that I will go to the grave saying, that like, He put on one of the greatest dunk contests of all time. And I think that it gets lost in the hullabaloo about, like, oh, why can't Aaron Gordon win, even though he's probably the greatest dunker of our generation? But I think people need to go back and rewatch that with a more critical eye, because Derrick Jones Jr., I mean, the man is nicknamed flight mode, or airplane mode, for a reason, right? Like, this guy's athleticism is unbelievable, and it's been the key to his whole NBA career. But anyway, sorry, continue.
No, I strongly agree. I think that if Aaron Gordon should be given one, it should be the 2016 one, but
Exactly.
we are way too late for that to happen.
That
But with Derrick Jones
should
Jr.,
have been a
if
tie.
yeah, well, yeah.
Ties go against the nature of sports for any country, not
Yeah.
even for exhibitions.
Well, someone's not a soccer slash football fan, I see.
Anyway,
Correct.
All right, fair enough. Walked directly into that one, didn't I? No, but with Derrick Jones Jr., again, it's been very abundantly obvious that, okay, this is a guy who can jump higher than basically anyone else. The question really was, does he do enough else outside of essentially finishing around the basket and rebounding to earn himself consistent minutes? And, it's fallen off pretty significantly over the second half of the season, but the big reason that he's sort of cemented himself in Dallas as opposed to in his previous stops is he's shown much more ability to hit and to take three-pointers. And, that's been huge just in the sense of, look, again, sort of going back to the Champagne discussion in particular of, what do you do to earn yourself consistent rotation minutes, right? And with Derrick Jones Jr., it's okay. I'm in Dallas, I'm playing alongside Luka Doncic. What do I need to do? I've got the roll man thing down. I've got the cutting to the basket thing down, but what do I do outside of that? And I think he's taken pretty significant steps forward on defense, which is the first step of all of this. But ultimately he doesn't start 66 games in Dallas this season without having shown an improved three-point shot, but also a willingness to take that shot is a huge part of it. I mean, the example that I use all the time is, one Rajon Rondo season in Sacramento, he shot 37% from 3-point range. He's like, okay, great. He did it on two attempts a game, and every single one of those attempts was completely wide open. And the other, 98 possessions of the game, he was left completely wide open beyond the 3-point line. That doesn't help your spacing, right? It's like, okay, congratulations, you hit the two wide open ones every once in a while, but defenses aren't paying attention to you. Defenses aren't caring about you out there. And when you have Derrick Jones Jr.'s level of athleticism, the ability to just force a defender to, not go under on every single screen, right? Just that alone is a huge element for him of, okay, I actually have to pay attention when he doesn't have the ball in his hands, because he's not just going to be standing there waiting for an open lane. He's someone who can actually, not only can do damage to us when he's left wide open beyond the 3-point line, but will. That's a pretty significant step forward for him beyond just, okay, he's canning those three-pointers at a career high clip, which he is, even after his, sort of shooting downturn over the course of the sort of closing stretch of the season. Even without that, his willingness to take them at a much higher rate just forces defenders to deal with him in a different way that they hadn't had to prior to this in his career.
Yeah, totally agree. And I give a lot of credit to the Miami Heat, I think, which is where Derrick Jones had the best stint of his career prior to this year, I think. And they kind of figured out that, like, hey, this man's a bit of a jack of all trades on defense. And we know that if we want to have him on the floor for his defense, we got to figure out how to make him at least a semi-credible offensive player. And no one's going to mistake Derrick Jones Jr. for Stephen Curry anytime soon. Soon, but to Nick's point, you just have to get the shooting volume to a floor is almost more important than the accuracy. And I think we've finally gotten there in Dallas.
So, next on our list, I'm going to turn to Mike on this, is a player who I think is near the top of the list in terms of the unexpected aspect of it. And I think, Mike, also, you probably have a particular reason, in addition to his actual play and his involvement on a team, for wanting to talk about him.
Yeah, this is Vanderbilt's finest, Scottie Pippen Jr. And he was a two-time All-SEC player at Vanderbilt, but smallish point guards who haven't demonstrated an ability to hit from distance just don't carry much weight in the NBA and draft circles. So he ended up going undrafted, and for good reason. Like, you look at the league today, and there aren't that many small point guards who can't shoot threes who are doing well, right? Like, give or take, like a TJ McConnell and Scottie Pippen is smaller than that. And it's hilarious because in college he was always listed at 6'3", And I'm like, you look at him on the TV and you're like, that man would be lucky if he's cracking 6 feet. And now that he's in the NBA, he's listed at 6'1", which I think is probably a lot closer to the truth. But he, you know, he went undrafted, signed with the Lakers last year, basically didn't play, did pretty well in the G League, was spent most of this year in the G League as well. But over this last stretch, as the Grizzlies are out here putting 13 players on their injury report before a game, and mind you, typically an NBA roster only has 15 players on it. You know, Scottie Pippen has found an opportunity to step in and get some playing time. And he's really responded. And most importantly, he's hitting his shots. He's shot 43% from them on like 3.5 attempts per game over the 20 games that he's played, 15 of which he's started, mind you. So he's going up against NBA starters on defense. It's not like he's demolishing scrubs. And he has been a steadying force for them on offense, on a team that frankly just doesn't have that many NBA caliber players. He's looked like one of the ones who deserves time going forward, even when they're back at full health. The one thing that has translated is the thing that he was known for, which is his kind of on-ball defense. And I think for the Grizzlies, Taylor Jenkins, man, might be one of the more underrated coaches in the NBA, I think. And sometimes when you're a coach, it's almost easier, I think, to be given just a bunch of spare parts and be like, make this into anything that's not utter shit, right? Like, I think just like – and Doc Rivers, I think, famously is one of the best at this. Like, you give Doc a terrible team and he will make them mediocre every single time. It's actually, I mean, that as a compliment. Like that, is, no, that does take talent. And I think Taylor Jenkins, you know, has shown that he's got that ability in spades, because you know, this Memphis team regularly puts out people that no one has ever heard of, and they have an above average defense this season, which I think is incredible. And you know, Pippen's play over the last month and a half or 2 months has been a part of that. He's averaging nearly 2 steals a game despite playing just 25 minutes. And it's not just the steals. Like, he gets up into guys. Like, he's a pretty physical dude for being so small. He's not necessarily somebody you want to switch a lot, but in terms of like just disrupting ball handlers, making it difficult for people to get into their sets, I think he's been really good. And it's exciting for me to see him. Like I said, I've followed him with interest just being a fellow Vanderbilt grad, and I want to see him succeed. And, you know, the Grizzlies have a lot of interesting rotation questions to make next season as they hopefully come back to full health. And, you know, I think we're all hoping for that, right? Like, it's not that long ago that the Grizzlies were the most exciting young team, kind of like a version of this year's Thunder. And I think we'd love to see them all get back to that level. But I'm hoping there's a role for Scottie to be in there as sort of like a defensive-minded backup to come in and, you know, play a little bit of the same role that Marcus Smart was supposed to play for them this year. So,
well, just like we knew that the Kings could not have a second consecutive year where no one is hurt and no one on the team has missed even a quarter of one game, that wasn't going to happen this year. Maybe we know, let's hope we know, that the reverse is true for the Grizz, and they cannot possibly have a year as bad as this year's one was health-wise. Let's hope anyway.
It's one of the craziest things I can remember, honestly. Like, I'm sure there have been other teams that have had more injuries, but I can't think of any off the top of my head.
It's virtually everyone. Yeah. So how do you top that? Right.
It's funny because the previous version of that in my mind, the team that I always thought of, oh, this is the most hideously injured team that I can imagine, is, you know, former friend of the Sacramento Kings, certainly Dave Yeager, when he coached the Grizzlies 2015-16. I'm pretty sure this year's Grizzlies broke that year's Grizzlies record for most players suited up over the course of the season. And that team got to the playoffs and there were like 3 healthy guys left. It was basically just a lie down. It was like, we don't have anyone to play anymore. But, you know, yes, history and statistics would tell us that the odds of the Grizzlies being anywhere near this injured next year are pretty much nil. But it is at least interesting to me that the previous example of almost incomprehensibly injured team was in fact a previous iteration of the Memphis Grizzlies.
Man, that is funny. I completely forgot about that, but that's a great call. The stat that I saw that cracked me up, this was a couple days ago. There's been like 2 games since, so the number might've gone up, but as of a couple days ago, they had played 50 different starting lineups. Yeah. And there'd only been 80 games to that. Right. You know what I'm saying? Like, that was the record by a lot. And, you know,
trying so if to play. Someone said to you prior to the season, there's going to be a team this year that has 50 different starting lineups, you would have said, I think, what are you smoking?
That is just like so hard to do. You know, like, that is injuries. That's not just like a couple of injuries to top end stars or to back end pieces. That is up and down the roster. Every level of the depth chart, like, you just can't get any, no stability at any spot. It's crazy.
So we had a great list and a great discussion. I'm wondering if either of you have any players that weren't on on the list that we put together that you think fit the criteria that we've been talking about today that we overlooked, or that now that we have maybe a little time left over that you want to talk about, or do we want to wrap it up?
I did have one guy that I wanted to just mention quickly, who Ray, you and I talked about already, but Chimani Kamara, as someone from this year's class, who, again, the sort of the knocks against him, I think, were it's one of those things where the knocks against him were overstated, and the, discussion of what he actually can and does do well was understated. And for Chimani, I mean, the fact that he's entering the season as it's an age 23 prospect, that certainly tends to dampen people's views about players' upsides. That's a discussion that just sort of always is going to come around in the draft world. And then, a lot of the questions as well were, okay, 6'8", incredible athlete, NBA ready frame, but what does he do offensively? And, it's funny because they're extraordinarily different players, but in a lot of ways, the answer is exactly the same as it is for Keon Ellis, where the answer is he does enough offensively. And as long as he does enough offensively to play, I mean, 34% from three on, not no volume, essentially all of his two pointers are, right around the basket. But what he does is, he covers pretty much one through four defensively and does so at an exceptionally high level. And so it's the kind of thing where, already it looks ridiculous that he was the 52nd pick in the draft, but again, he's someone who had a lot of sort of conflating factors that tends to lead to players being undervalued in the draft, all coming together in one package, and very almost immediately made it clear this season that no, the reasons to be skeptical were not strong enough, and the reasons that you should have bought in a lot more than you did.
So, Mike, anyone you want to? Oh, I'm
Well,
sorry.
no, I want to talk about Kamara for a split
Oh,
second
sure.
too, which is because I just wrote about him a couple days ago. And this is a stat that I love, which is like NBA.com has a tracker that shows you like the players that an individual player guards the most over the season. And Kamara's are hilarious. This is a rookie, and his top matchups guarded by minutes in order are Devin Booker, Curry, Doncic, DeJounte Murray, Kawhi Leonard, Lauri Markkanen, Aaron Gordon, Austin Reaves, and Desmond Bane. So it's like this guy who's a rookie and a big rookie, mind you, is out here guarding everyone from power forwards to point guards. Most of the names I just mentioned are living legends, Hall of Famers in the future. So hey, welcome to the league, rookie. Go guard these guys.
So excellent point. Do you want to add a discussion of any other player that we might have missed, or for
Yeah, the
whatever?
only other one, I didn't really prepare anything for this, but I do think that the Heat have one other guy that fits this criteria, and that's Haywood Highsmith. And it's funny because Haywood Highsmith is somebody who's been on the Heat for a couple of years now. But he, in fact, was, I think he was drafted by Philadelphia and didn't really stick, barely played for them. It might have even been a two-way, I don't remember. But then he spent 2 years overseas and before landing on his feet back in Miami. And I remember 3 years ago, when he first started with the Heat, I was like, oh, this is exactly like what the Heat need, like a good, perimeter defender. Like maybe he can shoot, maybe he can. We'll find out. But like they always need more guys who can guard on the perimeter. And I was a couple years early, but this year he's finally broken the rotation and stayed. And it's yet another guy where it's like, hey, the defense has always been there, but now that the shooting has caught up, or at least has been consistent enough for this season, right? And like the sample sizes we're talking about with someone like Highsmith are still very small in the grand scheme of a career, but all you can do is look at a guy's last 20 or 30 games and be like, yeah, this is looking like a real thing. And he's had 40% of his threes. He's not shooting a ton of them, but he's shooting enough of them. So going back to what Nick was talking about earlier with Derrick Jones Jr., right? Like you just have to hit a floor, a certain number have to be launched from you in order for you to be a viable supporting player in the NBA. Highsmith has finally hit that, and it's allowed him to do some like really awesome defensive things. He's one of the few guys in the league that will pick you up full court. Like he actually prefers to pick people up like right before half court. I'm not sure if there's something there with the backcourt or what it is, but he gets into people. He will like harass people for 60 feet in a way that most guys do not appreciate in the league. Because a lot of the guys who claim who look like they're playing full court, they're not really doing that. They're just too lazy to run all the way back, right? And so like they're trying to earn bonus points with the fans or the coach, and they're like sort of guarding a guy where they're like in his vicinity, but they're basically just walking backwards, kind of slowly. Highsmith will not do that. He is trying to get the ball from you, and he is successful more than you would think. So that's the last guy that I had that I thought deserved to mention in this category.
Okay. I enjoyed it. I learned a lot. I hope that that's true for all our listeners as well. I found this to be a fascinating discussion. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Mike. And thank you, especially everyone who listened to us today. And Mike, you want to send us all off?
I want to say again, yeah, thanks. Make sure you check out basketballintelligence.net to sign up for your daily email. Nick, I want to give you a chance to plug your stuff too.
Yeah, so No Ceilings NBA, noceilingsnba.com for any and all of your NBA draft related needs, and occasionally for reviews of rookie players and young players in the NBA, like we just did today. And then, on social at No Ceilings NBA on Twitter, No Ceilings TV on YouTube. You can find me at NBA Johnson, and that feed will essentially just be all No Ceilings and Kings Weekly posts. So, oh, and of course, Kings Weekly Pod at Kings Weekly Pod, where you can listen to Ray and I talk about the ridiculous enigma that is the 2023-2024 Sacramento Kings.